Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Many years ago, before I lived in the great city of Los Angeles, where I'm able to attend Allowed events, among other wonderful things, I lived in the great city of San Francisco, where one of my great joys was to drive out to Green Gulch Zen Center on a Sunday morning to hear lectures there and to sit in that beautiful barn. One of the teachers there whose lectures always resonated with me was Norman Fisher. As noted on his website, Norman's Zen teaching is known for its eclecticism, openness, warmth, and common sense, and for his willingness to let go of everything, including Zen. As well as being a Zen Buddhist priest, Norman Fisher is also an accomplished poet. For many years, he taught at the San Francisco Zen Center, the oldest and largest of the new Buddhist organizations in the West, where he served as co-abbot from 1995 to 2000. He's presently a senior Dharma teacher there, as well as the founder and spiritual director of the Everyday Zen Foundation, an organization dedicated to adapting Zen Buddhist teachings to Western culture. Norman's chief interests, in addition to poetry and traditional Zen and Buddhist teachings, are the adaptation of Zen meditation and understanding to the worlds of business, law, conflict resolution, interreligious dialogue, care of the dying. He's been for many years a teacher with the Zen Hospice Program, the world of technology, and pretty much anything else he can think of. Among his books are several collections of poetry, a prose memoir about Judaism and Buddhism called Jerusalem Moonlight, Opening to You, Zen-inspired translations of the Psalms, Taking Our Places, the Buddhist Path to Truly Growing Up. And his most recent book is Sailing Home, Using the Wisdom of Homer's Odyssey to Navigate Life's Perils and Pitfalls. And I was taking a walk in Griffith Park several months ago, and it was not long after a very dear friend of mine had died a quite untimely death, and I was listening to the podcast of one of Norman's talks on this book, and it was so powerful, and I felt so moved by it and felt something in me move that I resolved then and there that I would find a way to get Norman to come and speak to our Allowed audiences. So I'm very glad you made it here tonight so that you can hear this. And we also have the delightful pleasure tonight. Irene Borger will be in conversation with Norman. Irene is a writer, teacher, longtime writing teacher, and director of the Alpert Award in the Arts. She's a very gifted writing teacher, and she was the founder of the AIDS Project Los Angeles Writers Workshop and was for many years artist in residence at AIDS Project Los Angeles and edited the anthology From a Burning House, Writings from the APLA Writing Workshop. She's led writing workshops devoted to witnessing and not knowing for art makers and people living under conditions of extremity since 1990. And for the past several years, she's been writing about and investigating the art of listening. So please join me in welcoming Norman Fisher and Irene Borger to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
We've been having such a good time talking since Norman's plane came in, and Norman had the idea that we should actually just start the conversation and before you guys came in.
At 6:30, I thought, just start talking.
One of the things about, I don't know how many of you have had a chance to see the book? So a smattering. One of the things that I was unprepared for when I started to read it was the fact that it's not only about the Odyssey, but it's really about a process of transformation and homecoming. And so we were, and it has exercises in it, which Norman has agreed to work with today, mm-hmm. tonight. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you say is that there are on some levels there is maps but no maps. And it seems like that's what the book's like in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really, I was using the Odyssey. In the book, I'm using the Odyssey as a map of the spiritual journey home, which I think we're all on. Because I think if you are born and you die and you're trying to find meaning in your life, then that means you're on a spiritual journey, regardless of whether you think you're a religious person, a spiritual person or not. And I was trying to use the map of the Odyssey and read it as a map of the spiritual journey and see what that looked like. And one of the things that the story tells you is that part of the journey is setting out to sea. And when you set out to sea, you don't know where you're going to end up. The sea is mysterious. You look out at the horizon, and there's no end to it. And so that's the paradox. There are different maps of the spiritual journey and sort of explanations of it, but no life follows those maps and those explanations. It's essentially unknown. Yeah.
And one of the things that we talked about, that you've talked about in the book, is that Odysseus is the hero, but he's a flawed human being. He's not like Buddha or Moses.
Yeah, so that's the interesting thing, is that all our great religions are really based on the biographies of the founders, who are extraordinary people. You know, Jesus, Moses, Buddha. So we're doing those practices, and we are always a little bit frustrated because we're supposed to be imitating, you know, these great figures, and we come up short. And so there's a way in which all our striving ends up making us kind of unhappy. You know, religions can be very oppressive in this way, right? So it was interesting to take a figure who is very distinctly flawed and follow his journey, because it sounds more like us. You know, I think most of us are pretty distinctly flawed, and a lot of bad things happen along the way. A lot of difficulties arise, and how to handle those difficulties and make those difficulties part of the path instead of, whoops, I made a mistake, I'm off the path. No, the difficulty is the path. And that's exactly what happens in the Odyssey. I mean, it's all about the difficulties of Odysseus being blown this way and blown that way and having to overcome this and having to overcome that. Some of the things that happened to him happened because the wind blew him this way and it wasn't his fault. But there are other things that happened to him where he falls asleep at the wheel and messes up, and it is his fault, and he has to deal with that. So I thought, wow, this is really true to life. You know, we're really like this. You don't see those moments in the story of the Buddha or the story of Jesus or the story of Moses. Well, Moses a little bit, you know. But but otherwise, our religious heroes are individuals that don't seem to be like us.
There's a line that I thought was really quite funny. Let's see. Oh, yes. You said, any moment is any moment is a catastrophe, a total disaster, a fierce and bracing challenge if we are awake to it. And then I was thinking, okay, so there are all these disasters, and then it's like the story and the book, your book, is, in a sense, how to make use of disasters.
Yeah. That's right. How do you make use of the disasters? Because mostly what we do in our lives is try to avoid disaster. We spend, when you think about it, what do you do every day? You know, you'd spend your days trying to avoid bad things happening. You know, you go to work so that you'll have enough money so that bad things won't happen to you financially. You take care of yourself and go to the doctor so that bad things won't happen to your health. But in fact, these things do happen. And if every time something happens, it's a failure and something that you flee from and that you can't handle and that you feel ashamed of, then you won't really be able to engage with the reality of your life. It's in the disasters, in the tough things. And they could be big, tough things, but they could be very small, tough things. It's engagement with those things that really constitute the truth of our spiritual lives, of our human lives. I think so.
There's something about the book, the structure of the book. And when it starts, there's you know, here he is, he's setting off, he's determined. And part of my reaction was like, oh my God, can I be that determined? And then, so I felt, I actually, it's not until the book progresses, until in a sense, as you explore the fact that it's not that you solve things once, but you keep having these opportunities over and over again, yes. And that in some ways there's no blame, that there's a, I felt a kind of relief set in.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that was part of it. I mean, I think working with people in their spiritual practice, in their spiritual process over many years, you can't help but notice that this perfectionism or feeling of we're not doing it right or we're not able to do it or something like that is such a huge thing that we all have. I guess it's part of our heritage. You know, ever since Adam and Eve messed up, you know, we've all been in trouble, you know, since then. So so I thought that to overcome that, to follow the journey of a flawed hero, like I was saying before, it really is liberating. It kind of frees us up. And you realize, oh, it's not that I'm messed up. It's that this is what happens in a human life. Every life has these challenges, and it's meeting them that is what counts.
You know, it's interesting that you're saying that, because as I was reading the book, I started to think of Obama. And I actually...
really?
I did. I'll tell you why, because I wrote down these... Okay, so here... See what you think of it.
Okay.
So on one hand, Obama is a compassionate servant, a father, one with a vision. He has a sense of loyalty. He has the ability to hold his emotions in check.
Yes.
An unerring focus on a goal. Not only he reflected on his past in writing his memoir, even if you read, did you see that piece in the New Yorker that was an old interview with him?
Yes, I saw
so
that.
So even his description of his wife remaining a mystery to him, even though they were close.
Yeah, that was quite wonderful.
Like some things
thought,
at the
yeah.
end of the book.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
And so, but yeah, I've been, I mean, I'm not the only one. I think people are obviously worried about Obama, but because he's getting all this projection of heroism and people wondering when that's going to turn. Mm. So, I mean, do you feel that there's any kind of kinship between Obama and...
Well, now that you've list those qualities, yeah, that's... It does make sense to me. But there's one big difference, I think, and that is that Odysseus is a trickster. He's a deceiver. He tells many false stories. That's his great characteristic, is that whenever he's asked a question, he always lies. And his lies are very convincing, and his stories are very convincing. He's also a master of disguise and deception. And this doesn't seem... in fact, it's the absence of that is what is so refreshing and powerful about our president. So that's one, you know, one really big difference. And I think that a lot of the, in a way, part of the point that I make in the book is that, now, probably most of you are not deceptive liars and tricksters. But in a way, you know, we all are. In a way, we all are, because to be a person in the world means you have to construct some kind of a personality. You have to be somebody that's sort of presentable. And maybe inside, that's not actually who you are. But you have to be somebody. So in that sense, that's how I interpret the trickster quality of Odysseus. That in that sense, we're all tricksters, we're all deceivers. But our inner lives, we may be quite different. So it's that quality of deception, the difference between who we actually are inside and who we project ourselves to be outside, that's where we get into trouble. That's where we get into difficulty, because we can lose track of ourselves, of who we really are and what really matters to us in favor of maintaining this social self. So that's how I interpreted, you know, that aspect of Odysseus's life. It's the deception of Odysseus that gets him into trouble, and it's our deception that gets us into trouble. And I think that we're hoping that, and I actually am very enthusiastic about our president, because I think that as a just a on the scale of decency, human decency, of goodness of a human being, I think that he ranks very high, it seems to me. I mean, I never met him, but I have this feeling, and I think we all do. So I actually am not worried about him, because I think that he is less deceiving outwardly and inwardly than most of us are. And so I think, I really believe that he's going to stay on his feet and that he's going to be okay. And the interesting thing to me is that it's very possible that with all the confusion in our society and in our government, he may not be able to govern. He may not succeed because it's nobody could. But the interesting thing is, how much will it matter that a person, assuming that this is so, that a person at that degree of integrity is in that office, how much will that alone matter, regardless of what he's able to do or not do?
And I mean, what it inspires in other people.
What it would inspire in other people and how it could change the country, just that alone, to be consistently acting out of integrity in a way that is not a political ploy, but is actually who you are. What will that mean for all of us? And that to me is the interesting thing about him. And Odysseus actually doesn't have that much integrity as a character. You know? By comparison, you know?
Didn't you say that in part the deceit moves the plot forward, that's one of the functions?
Yes, that's right. There's a deceit, and that's true for us as well, you know? The deceit that of our lives and all the trouble that it gets us into is the trouble we need. In other words, it's not a mistake or a problem or we shouldn't be that way. This is life, right? Life is going forth and becoming somebody, and becoming somebody in the world is automatically being, to one extent or another, estranged from, you know, your basic self. And problems come from that, and those are the problems you need to go forward. That's right.
And one of the things about deception, I think you were writing about, was that in some ways fear underlies it.
Yes. Yeah, and fear strikes me as one of the most basic of all human emotions. I think we all have a lot of fear, most of which is unacknowledged and we don't even feel it. But, fear of presenting ourselves, fear of the future, basically fear of losing our lives, which we know we will at some point, and we don't really know how to think about that. So I think that so much of what we say and do and feel has fear as an underlying basis, and it really conditions how we live our lives.
I wonder if that's a good place to go into the sea. What do you think?
Yeah, let's try that. Yeah. Let's see. I thought we would try something. I'll read a few pages to give you a flavor for the book, and then it leads us to a kind of imaginative exercise. So let me read the pages, and then I'll check with you and see how you're doing, and if you're up for it, we'll do this imaginative exercise, okay? So I'm going to read a section that talks about the character Odysseus, and it'll say a lot of the things I've been saying. These are the opening lines of the Odyssey. I'm quoting here. "Sing to me of the man, Muse, the man of twists and turns, driven time and again off course, once he had plundered the hallowed heights of Troy. Many cities of men he saw and learned their minds, many pains he suffered, heart sick on the open sea, fighting to save his life and bring his comrades home." Those are the opening lines of the Odyssey that sort of in shorthand form give you a sense of Odysseus's character. And he's not a simple man. He's been buffeted about by time and fate. He's endured a lot, has been thwarted time and again by forces beyond his control. In his travels, he's encountered and observed many sorts of people, and he's learned to make use of their ways to further his own aims when he could. He has few illusions, for he has known hardship, despair, and suffering. A leathery, shifty fellow, Odysseus is a character actor more than a leading man. He's a survivor. He can be brutal when he is cornered, and he is just as willing as the next person to plunder and pillage as he did at Troy. But he is at the same time deeply loyal, enduringly true to his wife Penelope and to Ithaca, his native land. He's a great talker, a storyteller whose tales, most of them false, are always persuasive. He's also a master of disguise, who can appear as a beggar or a mighty warrior, depending on the situation. From time to time, he succumbs to his passions, or even to his world weariness. Often at crucial moments, he does exactly the wrong thing, compounding his problems. The Greek phrase, rendered here as a man of twists and turns, suggests that Odysseus' chief character trait is his wiliness. He is above all clever, deceptive, and persuasive. In ancient Greek culture, this sort of quick-witted, strategic trickiness was much prized. Thanks to their intellect, more than to their strength and courage, innovative, entrepreneurial people were able to craft and shape reality in order to win victories and advance societies. Athena, the goddess of wisdom, who also invented many domestic arts as well as music, appears frequently in the Odyssey as Odysseus' most important protector. She's also described as cunning and clever. And yet, prized and admired as these traits are, they are also problematic, for trickiness and cunning is just as likely to bring trouble as it is to get us out of it. This double-edged aspect of Odysseus' character figures strongly in his story, just as it does in ours. Because we too, in order to become people capable of surviving and thriving in this tricky world, have to be wiling and cunning. If we're too innocent, too naive, we'll be destroyed. So we have to become pleasing people, people who can shift and change as conditions warrant. But our cunning and trickiness have their downside, for the worldliness we develop to ensure our outer successes eventually becomes embedded in the identities that we craft for ourselves to get through this dangerous world. And we begin to believe our own deceptions and slowly drift away from our truer, more vulnerable, less presentable inner selves. And this may be fine at first, but as time goes on, it becomes untenable until one day, like Odysseus, we too find ourselves heart sick on the open sea. So then I go on to explain that the plot of the story is that Odysseus goes to Troy, where he fights at Troy for 10 years. The war ended, he's coming home. It takes him 10 years to get home to Ithaca. While he's gone, suitors have moved into his house and are now slaughtering his cattle and drinking his wine and, you know, eating up all his stores. And little by little, the household is disintegrating, and he has to return home and get rid of these suitors. And this happens to us too. Without maintenance, a house falls down. Without weeding, the fields go wild. And without tending, our inner lives will slowly but surely become disordered, you know, while we're away and not taking care of them. So that when we need them most, when the circumstances of our mature lives require them, our moral fiber, our wisdom, our compassion, and our love may no longer be there for us. So we need to, in other words, not leave them alone. We need to cultivate them our whole lives through. So that's a little bit about our hero, Odysseus, and how we're like Odysseus. Now, most writers on the Odyssey don't mention the fact that actually there's a second hero to the Odyssey. And the second hero is the sea itself. And in world literature, the seascapes of the Odyssey are very famous. When you think about it, the plot of the story takes place on islands, the Greek islands, and Odysseus has to go from one island to the other to have the next adventure. But in between the islands, he has to go out to sea. And this is where you find some of the most poetic and terrifying descriptions of the famous wine-dark sea, which sometimes swells with mountainous tumult, heaves with steep valleys, blows up fearsome gales, glows in the sunlight, glistens at midday, shimmers in the moonlight. It is the province of powerful gods who control its flow and use its power to achieve their own ends. And whenever the action of the story is advanced, you have to first go out to sea. And who knows what's going to happen once you go out to sea. The French philosopher and mystic Simone Weil writes about the sea, "It is not less beautiful in our eyes because we know that sometimes ships are wrecked by it. On the contrary, this adds to its beauty. If it altered the movement of its waves to spare a boat, it would be a creature gifted with discernment and choice and not this fluid, perfectly obedient to every external pressure. It is this perfect obedience to external pressure and not to us that constitutes the sea's beauty." So the sea is one of Odysseus's great enemies. And he's always getting shipwrecked and messed up and thrown off course by the sea. And in the beginning of the Odyssey, this has happened to him, and he's on an island, marooned on an island, held captive by the goddess Calypso. And you see him in the very beginning, gazing out to sea. And this is something that we all like to do, you know. We all like to go to the beach and gaze out to sea. Why would we want to do that? What are we looking at when we gaze out to sea? I think when you think about it, everybody likes that. Everybody finds it calming and interesting and worthwhile to be at the shore and to look out at the ocean. Why is looking at long, constantly moving spaces that recede out as far as the eye can see and far beyond so satisfying, at times compelling, and yet at the same time oddly disturbing? Perhaps when we look out to sea, we become Odysseus musing on our long-lost home, wondering when and how we will return. Now, I happen to live on the sea, so I spend a lot of time looking out to sea. And it never gets tiring. The sea is like my life, and it's like your life too. It's very large, larger than any of us know. It's full of currents and depths. It's constantly in motion. Sometimes it's very quiet and peaceful and beautiful. Sometimes it's full of white caps and crashing waves. And it's always, as Simone Weil says, perfectly obedient to forces that we will never understand. So just the same way that the sea is a major character in the Odyssey, it's also a major character in our stories as well. For we advance the action of our story, whether we appreciate this or not, by launching forth to sea, shoving off into the unknowable, powerful, unpredictable sea of life, of time, of the world. And we set out with some trepidation because we know we can't control or even completely understand what will happen to us. And we'll be tossed this way and that. We will be taken somewhere, whether we want to go there or not. For no matter how skillfully we sail and how fervently we pray for good winds, unexpected disasters constantly occur. Is this making sense to you?
Yes.
Yeah. So here's where the exercise comes in. How are we doing? Are you ready for this? Okay. So let's begin by paying attention to how we're sitting in our chair. So you might want to sit up a little straighter, just to be more, a little more alert, a little more aware. And just notice, bring your awareness to your body. You know, feel your butt on this nice soft chair. Feel your back, your shoulders, your arms. It would be good to close your eyes, probably. And just be with your breathing. Just for a moment or two, we'll be quiet and check in with ourselves, each one of us. Just feel what it's like to be here. What's going on in your mind right now? What's the feeling that you have right now? And be with your breath. And now, as you feel your breathing going in and out, the unknown, deep ocean of my life. And don't try to answer that question too quickly. Just be with it as you visualize the sea. And just wonder, where are the depths? Thank you very much. Everybody was really quiet. Isn't it nice? Quiet. Now, I'd like to do one more thing. Again, if you're willing, I hope that you'll be willing to do this. And that is, this is, you know, usually you don't, this isn't done, but I think we should do this. And that is, turn to the person next to you and have a conversation. That'll last about 3 or 4 minutes, very brief. And I just want you to talk to each other, now that we're all friends. Just talk to each other about what just happened. What was that like? What was that like for you to do that? If anything, what happened? Okay? So just for a minute, you know, talk to somebody. It's an interesting thing to do, to talk to somebody about something that matters for about 3 or 4 minutes and see what happens. So everybody find someone nearby and talk just for a few minutes, and then I'll stand up and wave my arms around, and that'll be time to end, okay? So have a conversation, and Irene and I will have a conversation up here. So again, thanks for your willingness to do that. It's nice to talk to people, isn't it? Yeah. So I just want to take a few minutes to see if there's some comments that anybody has anything to say about this.
And Norman, we do have a microphone because we do record for podcasts.
Okay, so somebody's walking around with the microphone. So a couple of quick comments. Anybody who wants this, just say what that was like and what happened there. Yeah, here's somebody right here. Yeah.
Undoubtedly, because you were talking about the sea, I was transported to a time when I lived by the sea, and in fact, on the sea for a while. And what was extraordinary for me was I felt that I was doing it again. I was back there, and at the same time, because of the context in which you were talking about the sea, I was seeking to interpret what that experience meant to me at that time, which I didn't do at that time.
Yes, right. Isn't that wonderful? Yeah.
Yes. What the extraordinary thing for me was that I was transported.
Yes.
I was not here anymore.
Yes. Wow. Yeah, I think that so many things, that's part of the point, you know, is that so many things that go on in our lives, which we take at face value and take for granted, have depths and dimensions to them that can be quite astonishing, and we didn't know it at the time. Yeah, wonderful. One or two more? Carol down here. Hi, Carol.
I had never used these words before to myself, the language of what are the depths of my own life. And I found that quite interesting that I had never used that and connected the idea of the depths of the ocean to the depths of my life. And I was interested by the fact that I hadn't used that language to myself.
Yeah.
And felt the connection between myself and the ocean, so I could feel the ocean's depths and my depths, and therefore just making a connection between myself and the ocean, and mm-hmm. then with all things. So mm-hmm. it's like a new metaphor.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank
Wonderful.
You. Thank
yeah.
you.
Last one, one more over here.
I question whether most people who sit on the beach and look at the ocean have a true understanding of the strength of the ocean.
Uh-huh.
And I think that Odysseus, who obviously developed an understanding of the ocean, developed a cunning that he had to in order to survive in his life. While most of us don't have to develop such cunning as he did, because our lives are not challenged as much as they were for him. Also, I think that more and more people are taking trips on cruise ships because they don't want to be challenged as much as you would be if you were on a regular boat. And they want to be in control of their lives.
Yes.
And therefore don't take as many chances in life.
Yeah.
As might make one's life a little bit more interesting.
Yeah, well, I think everything that you say is certainly true. But you could also look at it a different way, and you could also say that the cunning and the challenge that Odysseus faces is exactly the same challenges that we face, except we don't know it. You know, it's explicit in the Odyssey. It may be quite challenging to go on a cruise. Not physically, for sure, but, you know, inwardly, I think it's actually a very deep and challenging proposition to live a human life. And as Carol was indicating, I think most of us don't see that and don't access that and don't go there. But it may be. Anyway, but I appreciate what you're saying. Yeah. So thank you for doing that. It's a wonderful thing to think about your life differently, even for 3 or 4 minutes, and then to be willing to talk to someone else about that. It's a profound thing because we're all, I think that's really the point of the book and to me, of the spiritual journey is we're all living incredibly deep and resonant lives, whether we know it or not. And to take a moment to see that and to share that with someone else is one of the most wonderful pleasures in a human life. So thanks for doing that.
Norman, there's a few elements that are both in the book and are coming up in conversation. So one of them has to do with it feels like the story is really also a map for individual creativity. And I'll tell you why I thought that. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and Carol, this has to do with metaphor and the metaphor of the sea.
Yeah.
I'd like to read that the lake off. Closer. Let me whisper in your ear. Okay. Leaving home, waiting, confusion, parts unknown, setting out to sea, being nobody, listening completely, moving towards something, what you called inner ripening. And then I found this, you quoted Gerhard Richter, and he said, I like continual uncertainty.
Huh.
Right?
I quoted Gerhard Richter
another talk, talk you gave. I think it might be the talk on bewilderment.
Yes.
But it seemed to me that, in some ways, that challenge actually is in the creative process and people's unwillingness or inability to tolerate not knowing. We were talking before about people who write and don't write. And
yes.
Norman was saying that he just goes ahead and writes. And I think I think what that is in some ways a testament to is faith, I think. Or does it also have to do with what you were talking about? Well, let's hold that for a second, because I just want to ask you about forbearance and faith, but I'd like to read the business about metaphor, because certainly that's one of the great themes of the book. This is Metaphors We Live by George Lakoff and Mark Johnson, and it's the quote you used to head the book. It is as though the ability to comprehend experience through metaphor were a sense, like seeing or touching or hearing, with metaphors providing the only ways to perceive and experience much of the world. Metaphor is as much a part of our functioning as our sense of touch, and as precious.
Isn't that a great quote? Did you all hear that? That's a, you know, think about that. Think about the possibility that there are things going on in our lives every day, every minute, and we don't have a sense organ that perceives them the way, you know, an eye perceives an object of sight and a sound perceives, an ear perceives a sound. And the only organ that we have for perceiving these things is metaphor, because they're literally in the dark. And it's only metaphor that, to whatever extent it possible, brings them into light. And that then would give you a whole other way of understanding why art and literature are important to us. Because they're really giving us vital information about things that are going on with us every single moment of our lives. And that's why that is the epigraph for the book, because suppose that's what the Odyssey is. Suppose the Odyssey is actually a sense organ for us, as is all great literature, that enables us to see something about our own lives. That's what I was saying to you, that even though, yes, on one level, our lives are not nearly as challenging as Odysseus's life, on another level, on the level of metaphor, maybe in the dark, you know, who knows what's lurking in the hearts of all those people on that cruise ship? You see what I mean? All kinds of stuff is going on there. So I think it goes to what you're saying, Irene, about not knowing and the unknown and trust. Because the more we are willing to move into this territory of metaphor, and to know, even to know that much, to know, oh my gosh, you know, there's a whole lot going on in my life that I'm probably not aware of. And through, meditation practice has been a great theme for my life, because one does the same thing in meditation practice or in prayer or in religious life. You're going into the unknown. After all, what could be more unknown than God, for instance? You know, the idea of God is really saying, you know, this is a big space that we can't know. So that's what religious life is, I think, also. So the more we acclimate ourselves to just that reality, and the more we become familiar with metaphor and all kinds of religious practices that put us in that territory, the more we can trust that, yes, I'm not going to know, and I'm not going to be able to be in control. That's really the truth. When it comes to the things that matter the most in our lives, we are not in control. And yet, I can trust that somehow this unknown sea of my life will cast me up on the shores that I need to be on. Maybe they won't be the ones I planned on, maybe they won't be the ones I liked, but wherever I'm cast up, I'll be able to deal with that, and I will deal with that as my journey. So that's very much what I think the spiritual journey is about. It's because when we are afraid, when we don't trust what happens to us, when we say, that was not supposed to happen, but it did. Mm. Now what? Well, as long as we stay with, that wasn't supposed to happen, the world crossed me up, I'm not accepting it, well, we're really stuck, you know? You can't go anywhere from there. It's only when you say, okay, well, this is what happened, and this is where I am. I didn't plan on it, I didn't want it, but this is the journey. Then something happens.
You made me just think of something that Ivan Rand talks about, meditation teacher, and a friend of both of ours. She talked about how when you give your word, even to yourself, to, and you you undermine your confidence by not living up to your word.
Yes.
And one of the things that seems... Well, I guess I have a question about this, since you're a teacher, and since you clearly... I wonder if you would talk about, A, forbearance, and two, have you noticed... What have you noticed has actually been most effective for people to develop their confidence in this arena?
Well, first, about forbearance, which is another word for patience, but it's a stronger word, forbearance. It's not a virtue that is much prized around here. Around here, I don't mean like in this room or in this city. I mean in our whole kind of culture, you know, in Western culture. Because our idea is, you know, we can fix anything. And we're going to fix it right away. And it's a very shaky business or too passive to not go out there and fix it and make sure we fix it. But the truth is that a lot of things happen that are not fixable. And the effort to fix them is often an avoidance mechanism. And forbearance is exactly forbearing what happens without necessarily fixing it. So maybe you can fix it, but first take it in. Really see what it is. Because sometimes fixing something is a way of you know, avoiding it altogether. So can you really feel what something is and take in its full measure, even if it's something that's not good, that you don't like? Can you take it in? Can you breathe with it? Can you digest it? And based on that digesting of it, then fix it if it's fixable. And if it's not fixable, make a new life based on what it is that's happened. So, and it's just plain old-fashioned patience, you know, being present with what's going on, accepting it, looking it in the face, not avoiding it. And if you notice that you are avoiding it and you are unwilling to look it in the face, looking at that. Why am I not looking at this? Why am I afraid? Why am I glancing away every time? What's going on in me that I'm that way? So that's the practice of forbearance. And it's a very noble, it's a very old-fashioned virtue, you know, and very noble. And as I say, not a virtue that's highly prized in a sort of can-do, roll-up-your-sleeves-and-get-it-done kind of a world, which is our world pretty much up to now. But now that things have come to a screeching halt and we're all terrified about what's going to happen next, maybe forbearance is a much more valuable virtue, and maybe we'll get with the forbearance program now. Maybe we'll see that... That along with a stimulus package and a save the banks, we also need a forbearance package, maybe. All of us personally need to look at our lives differently. And maybe that would be a good outcome of these difficulties. So that's something about forbearance. And yes, I think Yvonne is exactly right about this business of eroding our own confidence in ourselves by not... talking to ourselves in a way that's, you know, really, really believable, and standing by our own word to ourselves. And it reminds me, when you were talking about that, it reminded me of my standard instruction when people say to me, I would really like to practice meditation every day. And, you know, meditation practice is really easy. When we were sitting there in the beginning of that exercise, and I was just saying, you know, feel your body, sitting there and breathe. Everybody was doing that. That's it. That's meditation. But there's nothing more to it than that. It's just sitting and being present. Pretty easy. And very beneficial. But people will say, well, that's great. I'm going to do that. But then they don't do it, you know. I mean, I can't get out of bed today. It's just too hard to do it. And I don't know. It just doesn't seem like really worth it. And it sounded like a good idea the other night when I went to that talk. But, So people say, well, how can I get myself to do this? And so here's what I tell them. I say, if you want to meditate in the morning, you should start the night before. And as you're going to sleep, you go to bed, and as you're falling asleep, you say to yourself, I'm going to get up tomorrow morning and meditate. You say that to yourself. But then you say, is that really true? And then you answer yourself. And if the answer is, yes, that's really true, then you'll get up the next morning. And if the answer is, no, I'm just saying that, then don't bother trying to get up. So this is what we do. You know, we don't ask ourselves the second question. I think that when you think about it, I mean, we're talking to ourselves all the time. In fact, you know, that may be who we actually are, is that stream of conversation that we're having with ourselves all the time.
And people are always, when people hear about silent meditation retreats, they're often horrified. They don't realize
there's so much conversation going on. That's right. Most of the conversation is going on under your breath, so you don't necessarily hear it. And that's one of the things about meditation. You sit there and you don't do anything else, and you start hearing all this stuff that's been going on all your life under your breath. And a lot of it is not very nice talk. And a lot of it is so that when we talk to ourselves consciously by saying, you know, making our great New Year's resolutions about how we're going to do this and that, it doesn't take into account all this other talk. And so that second question does that. That second question says, okay, you say you're going to do this, and you say you're all about this, and you say you believe in that, but do you really? Do you really? And then if you answer yourself honestly, you find out a lot about yourself. And I think, to me, going a little more deeply with our personal honesty is very, very important. Because I think a lot of us don't really want to be honest with ourselves. And there's a lot of pain in being that honest with oneself. But that's the only way to find out, you know, who we are and what's really important, is to get to that level of honesty with oneself. And so you ask yourself, am I really serious about this? What am I saying here? Who am I kidding? And really look, take some time to reflect. And maybe that's another thing we can do when we're looking out at sea, is talk to ourselves more honestly. Yeah, so that's really, really important. I think that we have to learn how to trust ourselves and know who we really are. And I actually think that that's not so common, to know who we really are or to trust ourselves. I don't think it's that common.
But, you know, this is hooking in with what's in the book, both for Odysseus and yourself, which was that Odysseus had a vision of returning home, so he was able to tolerate all the difficulties. And you write about yourself that you had such a clear sense that you wanted to live a life that was real, that even though you knew there might be difficulties in taking the path you did, you still had a vision. And you wrote in the book that you thought everyone had that.
Yes.
And so I found that very interesting that you wrote that you had that kind of confidence in other people in that way too.
Yeah, I'm absolutely convinced that everyone does have a vision like that for his or her life. And I think somebody, you know, was saying the other day, they were talking about a childhood experience of, you know, a powerful, really what it amounts to, a religious experience in childhood. And I was saying that, and the people who we were with corroborated this, that actually I think we all have those experiences. In other words, I think as children, I'm firmly convinced that as children, we all have an experience of what it would mean to live a noble and deep human life. And we all aspire to that as children. Now, we don't put it in that way. This is grown-up talk, the way I'm putting it. But in a child's mind, we have that sense of our lives. And I think that, and sometimes we have powerful experiences that corroborate that sense. It's not just a resolution, it's something happens. But I think that as we grow older, we have it knocked out of us. We, you know, we're sort of given the message that it's inappropriate or it doesn't make sense. And I actually think that most of us have had powerful religious experiences as children that we have literally forgotten, because as we grew older, it was less and less relevant to who, because we're all, when you think about it, you know, why is adolescence such a stormy time? It's a stormy time because you're moving from that childhood sense of, you know, what's real and full of integrity to how you have to be a grown-up in a confusing world. So you're forging a kind of grown-up persona, and you almost feel like you can't afford to carry those things from childhood. You have to set them aside in order to do that. And so I think that a lot of us kind of have forgotten this vision that we've had as children. And one of the things that happens in the religious life, I think, is that you remember. You come to remember. It isn't like, oh, no, I'm doing this wonderful thing that I never did before. It's like, oh, my God, I didn't realize that in doing what I'm doing now, I'm returning to something that I had left a long time ago and didn't even remember that it had been there in my life. So I'm really convinced that we're all born with this sense, this innate and very open and free sense of spirituality that we've lost track of. Because it is a very complicated and difficult thing to kind of get through life, you know, and get a job and get be in a relationship, raise children, all these are very complicated things. And so that kind of initial purity of vision gets lost in the shuffle. And often what brings it back is a disaster. I mean, I'm sure you all, many of you have experienced this, or if you're not yourself, have heard about it, of someone who hits a wall, you know, in their lives, an illness, a divorce, some financial disaster, and it wakes them up and it makes them remember who they are, and their lives change, if they're lucky, if they don't go down the drain, you know, that can happen.
Well, yeah. It sounds like some people might not call it a religious experience, but perhaps it's something larger than the self, some kind of connection with something.
Yes, exactly. Larger. Exactly.
And
that's part of the self. See what I mean? That's built into the self, that something larger.
Well, then, yes. And in some ways, it also connects with what you were writing about, the fact that in the Iliad, that's where the exploits and the heroics, in a sense, take place. And then, as the book goes on, as you're tracking Odysseus's return, you say it's not enough, in a sense, for self-realization at all. He goes on to work with, to really be with comrades and have a deep relationship with others.
Yes, yes, because once he gets home, he still has lots of work to do. I forget how many books of the Odyssey. I forget what book he. There's 24 books of the Odyssey, and I think he might get home on, I don't remember, but maybe book 18 or something like that. So there's lots that still has to happen after he gets home. So it's not just a matter of arriving home and everything is perfectly fine. To forge a real relationship with yourself at home and with those who are at home with you is the work of that period of Odysseus's life. Yeah.
And I think there's a really interesting contemplation to be done with what the metaphor of home is, of course.
Yeah, that's right. What is home for you? Sometimes that's an exercise that I've done with people, is to have people contemplate, you know, for you, what does that conjure up? What does that feel like? What does it really mean to come home in your life? And that may be a different answer at different times of life, when you're different ages and different stages of life. You know, what is home? What is returning home? Yeah.
Louise just gave me the signal, but what was it? Okay.
Oh, good.
May I say something that I mentioned to you that we talked about in the book, and really it's part of the reason I think the book has exercises in it, is because you are a teacher and you do. It's really an offering for people to have their own experience. And Norman wrote that often at the end of talks, instead of answering questions, he invites, he asks, instead of answering questions, he asks them. Yeah. So I don't know what you want to do right now, if that's something that might just happen.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. But let's see what's on people's minds. And I'll just call on people. Yes? Yeah, we have to get the mic to everybody.
Well, first I just wanted to say thank you, because I read your book about 3 weeks ago and it was remarkable.
Oh, thanks.
And but my question is really, what is religion really?
It's a good question. And there's, you know, one could give a lot of answers to that. But what I would say myself, and this is what I really think, religion is human life. That's what religion is, our lives. And I say human life because mule deer don't have religion. Raccoons don't have religion. And snakes don't have religion. They seem not to need it. But every human community that's ever been known has some form of religion. So that's what religion is. It's human living. And it's a recent invention, the idea of religion. The early people didn't know that word, didn't have an idea of, there was no such thing as religion. There was just life. There was just how we live together and what we believe and how we look at our lives. And how we live our lives, that's religion. And later on, we've, you know, made all these different branches of knowledge and activity, and we carved up the world into different things, and one of them is religion. But I think in the end, that's what it is. And so I really feel like it's a problem for us, actually, that we've compartmentalized religion, and that religion has compartmentalized itself, and it's reduced itself to doctrine and ritual. Those things are really valuable and really important, but the doors and windows need to be opened up in all the religions, and we need to have a much broader and more open sense, because in a way, what religions have done is they've closed down our questioning, and they're supposed to open it up, you know, but they've give us a format for engaging these questions, give us a metaphorical system and a ritual system and practices to engage these questions. And I think all out of self-protection, religions have closed down more than they've opened up. And so we need, I'm kind of working on the idea of the religion for a post-religious age. I think that's what we need now. Because it's just human life. I really believe that. Yes. This man over here maybe is...
When we were doing the meditation, I fell asleep.
Nice. You need a little rest, I guess.
Well, I dreamt that Odysseus used sail and he also used oars, and that was a very important distinction.
Yes.
And then that got me thinking about oars and two questions that I've had about the Odyssey, one of which is, what did he learn when he listened to the sirens? And the other... he was told after he returned home that he had to go so far inland,
yes,
that people would not recognize an oar and know what it was, and then and then plant it there. And
right.
I've never known what that meant.
Yeah. Yes, well, these are wonderful questions, and it sounds like you know the Odyssey pretty well, because that's an obscure... Tiresias' prediction for Odysseus' death. Yeah. Well, in the book, there are many, many possible ways of looking at things, of course, in the Odyssey, but I think what I say in the book about the sirens is that the sirens, and I'm, you know, reading closely the text to get this idea, the sirens seem to represent two things. On the one hand, they represent the past, the beauty of the past, nostalgia, if you will, the way that we look at the past often with very tender eyes and distort it. So they represent that, and they also represent our thirst and our quest for more knowledge and more experience and more life, more and more life, more and more being. And as you know in the story, those things are horribly destructive. If we get caught in nostalgia, this is very destructive to our inner life. If we get caught in a constantly seeking and searching and thirsting for new experiences, we are destroyed by that as well. On the other hand, we can't ignore those things. So the solution for Odysseus is to be lashed to the mast, to listen to the sound, the song of the sirens, which express those things, but to be protected from them because he's lashed to the mast and his men are making sure that he doesn't unlash himself. So, and then I interpret that as meaning some sense of inner discipline. So we have to engage one of the themes of the Odyssey, and one of the themes, I think, of our spiritual lives is that we have to engage with what's dangerous in our lives. We can't, you know, really sort of factor off things that are scary and dangerous and say, well, I'm not going to pay attention to that. And I think that's one of the things that religions have done for us that's, I think, somewhat negative, is they've said, well, you should be good, and so you should not engage all these energies in yourself. But I think we need to engage those energies, but we need to be protected because they are dangerous. So that's the siren. And then the sirens. And then the oar one, I think it's a very mysterious passage, and I've never read a good explanation for it. But clearly, it does mean that you, Odysseus, who spent his life on the sea with oars, and everybody on the Greek islands, you know, knows what an oar is because they're all islanders and they're all always at sea. So he has to wander so far into the interior, right, into the interior, that people don't know what that is. They have never seen an oar. They think, actually what it says is they think it's a winnowing fan, which is associated with agriculture and with growing things, and planting the ore is like making the ore into a tree, returning it to what it was originally, which was a tree. So there's something there about going back to roots, going back to the earth, going back to something that is deep and solid. And I think that's, and you know, that prediction has to do with Odysseus's death, because that's how he dies. He's supposed to do all this, and then he's supposed to sacrifice to the gods in that place, and then go home, and then he will die peacefully with family and friends. So that metaphor may have something to do with dying, and death and dying is actually also one of the themes of the book, because one of the ideas that I have about the spiritual life, which, I mean, it's not just my idea, I think it's many have said this, and it seems to be absolutely true, is that, and again, this is exactly the opposite of the way our society looks at this. You know, if life is the way we think it is, which is to say it's all about doing and being attractive and doing great things and so on and so forth, then there's a very bad design flaw in life. Right? Because that part only lasts a little while, and then we start going downhill. And it gets worse and worse and worse. We get less, you know, able to do things, and we get less attractive, and we get less energy, and our body falls apart, and we die. It's like a terrible idea. Who designed this, you know? Well, it could be a bad design, yes. The alternative, though, is it could be a really good design, and it could be that there's something spiritually potent in aging and dying that we have not even dreamed of. I mean, human beings have dreamed of it, but our society has lost track of it long ago. And I think that's what that metaphor says to me, is that there's something else in the possibility of returning to the earth in dying. And in the end, I think, you know, my own answer to all the different, many different answers that of what is home that you were bringing up before, in the end, in a human life, that's home, is returning to the place we came from in the beginning, the real home that we came from in the beginning before we were ever born. We're going back. What would it be like to understand that about your life and to live your life willing to go home when it was time and finding that a completion and a fruition instead of a failure, which is how death is viewed in our society. It's a failure. The doctor screwed up. We screwed up. We shouldn't have died. What's the matter with us? We should have taken better care of ourselves. How come we died, you know? I mean, really, it's death is a shame and a failure in our society. And so suppose we looked at it as the final voyage home, something that we looked forward to when the time came, and that it wasn't, quote-unquote, giving up to die when it's time to die. I think that's also a theme of the Odyssey. But I think it's so wonderful. You know, Odysseus doesn't die in the Odyssey. You know, it ends with him defeating the suitors and taking his place. But there is that prediction. His death is foretold in the Odyssey. It remains mysterious. It remains just in that metaphor. I'm glad you brought that up, because I find that one of the most haunting and beautiful passages of the Odyssey, yes. One or two more, okay. There's somebody in the third row in the back there.
Hi, thank you. It seems that, you know, when we go home, a lot of the things that were necessary on our journey become devalued, and it seems to me that you know, the returning home is returning to the norm and everyday life, and that, you know, people just don't value what you're doing out at sea and running from island to island. But and it seems to me what you're doing with this book, which I think is really fascinating, is you're reframing the first noble truth.
Right.
And it seems to me, and from my fishbowl, that we don't get it. Like, we don't understand the truth of suffering. And our Western minds just short circuit somehow.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you have a perspective on that, because, like, again, I'm in the fishbowl, and I have never been able to step outside myself enough to understand why, for Asians, the truth of suffering is so profound. And it seems to me that when it gets translated into English, it loses something.
Uh-huh. Well, I think it has a lot to do with... I appreciate what you're saying, and we were just reading... Irene gave me a copy of the famous Cavafy poem about the Odyssey, which is just like you say. Cavafy talks about, basically denigrates the coming home part and validates the journey part. And so I am reframing it in that way, as you say. But anyway, I think that... our Western culture has been for some hundreds of years now very much concerned with the material world in the linear present time. Because we can be, because it's been fascinating. We didn't know much about the world, and, you know, we've been gaining all this incredible knowledge about the world, which has made us very much focused on the material and the temporary. There was a time in the West, in the medieval period, when I think Western culture was just as much focused on the same realities that Asian culture was focused on. But the West really had to jump on the rest of the world in terms of material progress and scientific knowledge and so on and so forth, which seemed to have been built into our religions and our whole ideologies. It seemed to be a implication that didn't come out until whenever it was, when the scientific period began. So the more you're focused on the material world, the less the invisible world and the eternal world, seem important to you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.